This is Wade's World, where we talk to the most interesting people in the world on KABF 88.3, the voice of the people.
You want to see how the other half lives? You want to see how we get around? Why don't you come visit me?
This is Wade Reskin, and you're listening to Wade's World, a Voice to the People program. Welcome to the east side of town so that we can talk about how the other half lives and what life is like here living in Wade's World, whether that's the east side of Little Rock, Greenville, or New Orleans, or on Acorn Radio in Nairobi, Bengaluru, Bristol, or Bombay, points east and west, where we are either rebroadcast or live streamed at kabf.org, wamf.org, or acornradio.org. A podcast will be available, this show, on those websites and at www.chieforganizer.org. You know the story on Wade's World. We talk to the most interesting people in the world. Today, we're talking to Chuck Shuford, an old friend and colleague who worked for many foundations, funded community organizing in Appalachia around the country. He now lives up in Virginia, but we're not going to talk about that. We're going to talk about some other things. Welcome to Wade's World, Chuck.
Oh, thank you, Wade. It's good to be here.
Well, it's good to hear from you. And what we're going to talk about today is couldn't be more timely. We're going to talk about medical debt. You've gotten involved in that fight. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what's going on?
Well, I started reading these stories about medical debt, and I actually put a Google alert on my computer, and I started getting these stories every day from all over the country about people who can't pay their medical bills. And it just dawned on me that medical debt seemed to me as the most visible and palpable result of this profit-driven medical system we have. And it might be something that can help change things over time. But the thing to remember about medical debt is that it's a debt of necessity. I mean, people don't have medical debt because of extravagant spending. They have medical debt because they got sick or had an injury. And about 26% of U.S. adults age 18 to 64 say they or someone in their household either were unable to pay medical bills or had problems paying them in the past 12 months. Well, that's 52 million people. And residents in southern states have the highest shares reporting problems, and that was 32%. And what's really interesting is that among all the people with these household medical bill problems, more than 6 in 10 are covered by health insurance. And what does that say about the health care system that we have?
Nothing good. I mean, one of the things that is sort of between the lines right now in this current coronavirus situation is when people talk about tests or going to the hospital, that's not a free ride, is it, Chuck?
No, it's not.
There are a lot of people going to end up in this crisis with what we're talking about, medical debt.
That's right. And people, you know, without health insurance certainly are in trouble. But increasingly, as we said, people with health insurance, because deductibles are rising, co-pays are rising, and hospitals are beginning increasingly to sue for medical debt. Last August in Wise, Virginia, it's about 25 miles from where my wife and I live, there were 102 of the 160 cases on the court docket were brought by Ballad Health. They're the largest hospital, supposedly nonprofit hospital chain around here. And among the defendants, there was a school teacher, a correctional officer, a stay-at-home mother, and even a Ballad employee, you know, all of whom had private insurance but were still responsible for a large share of their bill. And Ballad operates the only hospital in Wise County. And
you don't have a choice.
You don't have a choice. And that's another... There's not a lot of data. Most of the data on debt is national. But in Appalachia, where I live, you know, our region is already recognized as one of the poorest and the least healthy. And the region's been dealing with the worst opioid addiction in the nation. And now with the coronavirus, it couldn't have come at a worse time for Central Appalachia. And by that, I mean southwestern Virginia, eastern Kentucky, and West Virginia, primarily the coal area because of the collapse of the coal industry, an industry that isn't coming back and that elected officials should have been prepared for and weren't. The Kaiser
Go ahead. I was just going to, you know, dive down on your point about hospitals suing on medical debt. I mean, I know you probably read this as well, but a couple of years ago, hospital in St. Joseph, Missouri, was the subject of a big ProPublica story and some others where they were suing everybody and their neighbor and dog. And it was, they had a subsidiary, you know, which is just, blows my mind, they had a subsidiary that was a debt collector. So they not only sued, but they made money.
It was in-house.
It was all an in-house. I mean, it was like their business model was no longer healthcare. Oh, and this was ostensibly a nonprofit. But now they had to back up partly because, you know, people reached out as well to Senator Chuck Grassley. And he, you know, threatened their tax exemption as a 501c3 nonprofit. But people don't realize this. We've been monitoring this in Arkansas, Louisiana, and Texas. But a lot of hospitals have a significant portion of their income. I'm not talking about 50%, but certainly 10-15% is about collecting debt at predatory interest rates. And some of them are like St. Joe's and have a subsidiary who's doing it. Why should they outsource somebody and give them 50% if they can do it themselves? I mean, it's, and all of it has to do with the pricing, as you talk about. But the problem of this coronavirus, I mean, Virginia is covered under Medicaid expansion or not?
Yes, just since we got a Democratic governor and they flipped the House and the Senate.
I thought that was exactly the case. So it's a new thing. So you have a lot of residue. Luckily, there is coverage now under this crisis, but Louisiana was also a late comer. Texas still doesn't have it. There, you know,
Tennessee
still plenty.
Doesn't have it.
Tennessee, you know, and TennCare was supposedly going to be the big insurance program there, and that hasn't worked out. Do you follow Tennessee? I know you spend a lot of time living there, but that's a real problem in Tennessee, isn't it?
Well, they're having a lot of hospital closings there. And the thing, you know, when we talk about insurance or health care reform and the things that need to be done, we immediately think of insurance, and that's true, and we think of pharmaceuticals. We don't generally think of hospitals, but we should. And before so I don't forget, any of your listeners who are really interested in understanding this system, I really recommend a book called An American Sickness. It's written by Elizabeth Rosenthal, and that's Elizabeth with an S. She's a Harvard-trained MD who left medicine, became a correspondent for New York Times for 20-plus years covering medical things, and she's now the executive editor at Kaiser Family Foundation of the Kaiser Health News. She really shows a lot of the cost drivers. But on the hospital thing, hospital spending is growing faster than the gross domestic product, faster than inflation, faster than wage growth. And last year, researchers at Yale and some other universities found that hospital prices increased 42% from 2017 to 2014 for inpatient care, 25% for outpatient care, compared with 18% and 6% growth for physicians. So most economists think hospitals could do just fine with far less than they get today from private insurance. And, you know, nonprofit hospitals are required almost 60% of our hospitals are nonprofit, and I want to put that in quotes. They're supposed, by federal tax law, they're supposed to spend their surplus on community benefits, which used to mean free or reduced price service until 1969, the tax code got changed to allow for a wider range of expenses, and charitable care became optional, and it was left up to hospitals to decide how to pay back that debt, and they could even declare that accepting Medicaid insurance was a community benefit, write off the difference between Medicaid payment and their own calculations of cost.
It's unclear that that's true now. I mean, one of the amendments to the Affordable Care Act a decade ago required hospitals that were enjoying a 501c3, and this was a Grassley amendment out of PEAK, but it still is a potential tool to prove that they were actually delivering charity care. We've been constructing a database. It means going through every 990, and you've come out of the nonprofit world, so you know what a pain it can be. And hospitals don't exactly go out of their way to make their charity care expenditures transparent. But there are hospitals. I mean, the average charity care is only a little bit over 4%, but we found huge hospital change. Ochsner Hospitals here in the Louisiana area, Herman Memorial in the Houston area. I mean, Ochsner does hardly 1%. If even all these nonprofits did 4%, just in these three states, we speculate it might make the difference of putting another $500 million into care for lower-income families, and that's particularly important in Texas. So your point is right on the money. We're talking to Chuck Stuford, who is a longtime veteran of foundation work and supporting community-based efforts to deal with social change issues. And he's become an advocate for why we need to do things differently in dealing with medical debt. Let's talk about deductibles, because that's one of the real problems here that's blocking people from insurance, isn't it?
Yeah. And when as the Trump administration began pecking away at the Affordable Care Act, they began to allow insurance policies that, my understanding is, would not have been allowed under the ACA. And a lot of those are really inexpensive until you get sick. And they're inexpensive because you're going to have a huge deductible before the insurance starts in, and that is hurting a lot of people. Plus, the copays have been increased as well.
One of the loopholes in the Affordable Care Act is if your employer provides qualified insurance, you're not allowed to benefit from the marketplace if your state has expanded Medicaid, even if your income would qualify you, because you're supposed to get insurance from your company. And you're not eligible, even if you go to the marketplace, for some of the extra incentives that make the payments affordable to lower-income families. We represent in our union, Chuck, a lot of nursing homes and workers who work in developmental disabled group home settings and community home settings. All of them have insurance, but nobody, because they're in Massachusetts, there was a limit. Deductibles could only be $2,500. But under the Affordable Care Act, we lost the battle to cap the level of deductibles. So I literally have companies that, have more than 50 employees, so they're required to provide insurance, who will then give us a plan that has deductibles, 4,000, 5,000, 6,000, 7,000, 8,000, all are qualified. I'll have HR people, in big chains like RedScare telling me, hey, Wade, I don't like it either. I've got three kids, but I've got a, I'll have 250 employees there, and I'll ask, well, how many are actually getting insurance? It'll be one, zero, because by the time you pay the 9%, which is allowable of your wages for the monthly premiums under Affordable Care, and then realize that if you got sick, even after paying that much, and you're hardly making $10, $11, $12 an hour, that you might have to pay a deductible of $4,000, $5,000, $6,000, you're crazy to have insurance, but you're also, and so nobody does take the insurance, but that means they they're prime candidates for medical debt because they can't get into the Medicaid expansion program, and they can't afford the company insurance. I mean, what a bizarre contradiction, huh, Chuck?
Yeah, and, you know, there was a, I don't know, I've got a note here somewhere about, you know, there was a survey recently that there was a high percentage of people that couldn't pay $400 if they had a surprise bill they weren't expecting.
That's widely reported. That's a matter of gospel now across the country.
Yeah.
People just don't have those reserves.
Well, and, you know, a lot of attention was given to surprise medical billing, and Congress thought they were going to solve that. And the money in politics showed what a real problem that was. But there's a real lack of price transparency. And one of the worst things, most hideous things that I've run across in the last 6 months is the fact of Wall Street buying up medical practices and emergency room staff. And that's how people end up frequently getting surprise medical billing. You go to an in-network hospital, but then you might get an out-of-network bill from a radiologist or an anesthesiologist because the hospital, it's cheaper for them not to have to maintain that. And these folks can charge anything. And it's just outrageous. It's just outrageous. You should, and there's some legislation that's trying to fix that now, that if you go into an in-network hospital, you can't get an out-of-network bill. But, you know, everybody thought, oh, this is outrageous, we're going to fix it. And then all the
lobbyists, an army of lobbyists got together because, yeah, supposedly this was a bipartisan thing and no bill emerged.
That's right. The doctors versus the insurance companies, they had all these ads going on TV. And if you watched them and didn't know, you'd be totally confused about what's right. So it's this whole for-profit thing is just gotten out of control.
Well, particularly when it has to do with life and death. I mean, people, you know, there's all these discussions now, including from the Trump teams about, you know, essentially what they hated before about the Affordable Care Act were death panels, but their ineptness in dealing with the health needs of Americans means that they may not have a panel, but people are definitely coming up with criteria on who should be, if there's limited respirators, limited ventilators, limited hospital beds, who ends up on the deathbed and who ends up getting saved.
That's right. And you shouldn't have to even have that conversation. We should be prepared for that. Well, if I may, let me talk about the only kind of source for dealing with medical debt right now that I know about that I got involved with. And it's charity, and we shouldn't have to use charity to get rid of medical debt in this country. But at this point, I'm not seeing many other options. But about a year ago, and this is really how I got into looking at more at medical debt, was a friend told me about a 501c3 nonprofit organization. It's founded by two former debt collectors, and the organization uses donations to locate and buy large bundles of medical debt, and they forgive the debt for individuals who earn less than two times the poverty level, or they pay more than 5% of their annual income to medical expenses, or for individuals who are insolvent. That is, they have medical debts greater than their assets. There are no tax consequences to the donors or the recipient. And the thing that really drew me to this strategy is that the organization, which is called RIP Medical Debt, buys debt for as little as a penny on the dollar. So any gift is leveraged 100 times. A $10 gift leverages $100 worth of debt. A $100 gift leverages $10,000 worth of debt. And my friend who told me about RIP, he and his wife convinced RIP to set up a debt relief fund for Appalachia. And so far, it's the only regional fund they've started. To date, the campaign has raised, well, it shows $518,000, which eliminates $51.8 million in debt. Nationally, RIP has relieved over $1 billion in debt. And what really, John Oliver, you may be familiar with the show This Week Tonight, the British comedian. It's the research.
HBO, right.
Pardon?
On HBO.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And you can see some of the shows on YouTube as well. But they highlighted the medical debt in RIP in 2016, and they contributed to RIP and eliminated almost $15 million in debt. And then things really, really took off for RIP. And over 70% of the donations come from individuals, many of those from churches, followed by foundations and then corporate contributions. From what I've seen from this Google alert, it's the churches all over the country, and they're not just mainstream churches. Some of the evangelical churches and so on are really at the forefront of this. And for instance, in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, last fall, the Unitarian Church raised $21,000, and there happened to be a match at that time. So with $42,000, Oak Ridge sits in the middle of two counties, so they wiped out all the medical debt in those counties and then a substantial part in Cock County, Tennessee, which is one of the poorest counties in East Tennessee. And I should point out, too, when I say the debt, it's not all the debt that's out there. It's what they can buy on the secondary market. It's what's available to buy, because, and I had no idea this is the way debt works, but, you know, a hospital can write off the debt. They try to collect if they don't sue people, and they sell it to a debt collector for maybe 15, 20 cents on the dollar. They write off the rest. The debt collector then has the right to collect that whole amount. And
I mean, it's the same way that consumer debt is handled, right?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Which isn't good, but it is the way it works. We're talking to Chuck Shuford about medical debt. He's gotten looking. And, you know, Chuck, I didn't realize the name of this was RIP medical debt, because this actual project has gotten a lot of publicity. I've read a lot about it without realizing it had a name and an actual 501c3. So I'm glad you're sharing that with us. So before we end the show, and we've still got some time to talk about this, well, perhaps you can tell people how they can find RIP medical debt. But this is an important contribution. It's good to hear the churches are on the leadership side on this.
Yes. And you know, I met with some folks down just south of Knoxville, Tennessee, who are interested in doing a campaign, but they have a new wrinkle. They said, we don't want to just raise money to do this. We want to raise money and see if we can also get at what's driving medical debt. We want to talk with our politicians. We want to research and see if we can have some organizing around this too. And I wish, and I hope there's some way over time for churches to become aware of this. And, you know, contact your congressman, your senator, and say, our church gave this much to eliminate debt. We shouldn't have to do this. This is not a charity issue. This is policy. This is your responsibility, and we want you to do something about it. And here's what's driving the cost. Now, we're a long way from that happening, but that would be a really big step forward. But until that happens, let me tell you, RIP Medical Debt, if you want to go look at their website, again, it's RIP, and there's no, even though it, I think it stands for Rest in Peace, there's no dot between. It's RIPmedicaldebt.org. And if you go to their webpage, and then in the upper left-hand corner, you'll see campaigns, and you can click on campaigns. and then it'll have hot spots, and Appalachia is one. And if you want to contribute to this campaign, that would be wonderful. You can click on Appalachia, but you can also look at all their campaigns. The other thing for churches, if there are churches, people listening, for $15,000, you can target counties. It doesn't. There's too much overhead and too much work for them to do it for less than that. But for that, you can then target geographically. Otherwise, you can give $10 like to the Appalachia campaign, and it'll be used. Or you can just give $10 to RIP Medical Debt, and they'll use it wherever.
We're talking about 500,000 cases of coronavirus or something. I know that there's a big headline in the New York Times today saying that we now have recorded more cases of coronavirus than China or any other country. We're talking about a 18-wheeler going towards the wall in terms of people in medical debt. If people were able to get tests, and if even a small percentage of those people end up in the hospitals, and there's nothing that has to do with, if you're lucky enough to be on a respirator or ventilator, that's an expensive procedure. And anything that has to do with an emergency room or ICU bed is, I mean, Chuck, our first child came out of, this was, you know, 36, 7 years ago, came out of an ICU as a premature baby. And, you know, they handed me a bill for $150,000 then, which I walked away from. You can imagine what kind of bill people might have if they're on a respirator for 2 weeks. You're talking six figures. And if they don't have insurance, and, you know, it's not something that the hospital is willing to write off as part of their charity care obligation. And we could have a whole discussion about campaigns to try to force better provisions on charity care, and we will at some point. But we're talking, I mean, somebody's really got to monitor this, and it's probably a bigger job than RIP Medical Debt can do. But in terms of the kind of campaign you're suggesting, we're talking about people, once this is all over, it's not going to be over for many people for decades.
No, it's not. And the kind of campaign I'm talking about really requires an infrastructure and a curriculum almost for educating people about our system, and that it's more than just insurance, and it's more than just pharmaceuticals.
Exactly right. And one of the things that people need to know, and it's apropos of what Chuck Schufer and I are talking about, is that if you end up in the hospital, you often have to almost force them to tell you about their charity care provisions. They're all supposed to put it on their website. They're supposed to give every patient coming in their policies. But what we found in looking at hospitals here in the Middle South area, and it's probably true in Appalachia and other places as well, is often that's honored in the breach. People are not informed that they might be eligible for charity care. You need to ask. It's your right. It's not charity. It's your right as part of the Affordable Care Act, and it could make a huge difference in keeping you away from medical debt.
And you need to ask for an itemized bill.
Exactly, because there's a lot of baloney in those bills. Now, Chuck, in your research, is there an average amount of medical debt that people have? Or
I don't think I have that.
You know, I have never seen that figure, too, but I think it's at least probably, you know, it's several thousand dollars for sure the last time I saw anything. And, yeah, you know, it can be as high as six figures. It can be as low. I mean, we've seen lawsuits in Texas from some of these hospitals over $150, $200 bill. I mean, so.
Yeah, it's really structural. And, you know, the other thing, and I mentioned this to you when you first contacted me, is we've really got to get politicians to get out of this American exceptionalism and look at what other countries are doing, because they figured this out.
Chuck, tell people again how they can find. We're at the end of our time, but tell people again how they can connect with ripmedicaldebt.org.
It's, go to ripmedicaldebt.org, O-R-G, and that'll have all the information. Up in the left-hand corner, you'll see campaigns. You can get a sense of the campaigns that are currently going, and you can get in contact with them if you want to start a campaign.
Well, and as Chuck was saying, in Appalachia, they have a special program. There might be a special program we should think about for the Middle South or elsewhere. Chuck, thanks a lot for being a guest on Wade's World. This has been Wade's World for another week, the world where the other half lives, where we talk about things you've never heard. And as Lucinda Williams sings, things you've never seen and will never forget. Wade's World is underwritten by the Darrow Foundation, a progressive force enabling change based in Little Rock, Arkansas. And as the song goes, we say it loud, we say it on the air, we say it on the radio. Until next week, when we'll have another guest, this is Wade Rasky for Wade's World. Thank you.